Hello, and welcome to Calamity, a podcast about natural and not-so-natural disasters. In each episode, we examine a catastrophic event from world history. We are your hosts, the Kuhlman Sisters.
I'm Jema.
I'm Jillian.
And I'm Caitlin.
All right, we're all here!
Yay!
This week's Calamity is going to be the sinking of the Lusitania.
Awesome.
Now, I realized a little too late that our last entry was also a boat sinking, then it came up again. so I'm not sure that one counts.
True. That's a good point.
Right, right. It wasn't a sinking.
I mean, it was a sinking, but it wasn't, I don't know, how do we say that? It wasn't its final resting spot.
It wasn't permanent.
There was a second chapter.
So you're saying, Jillian, that the Lusitania definitely sunk permanently.
Well, very little of it has come back to the surface.
Okay.
I'm going to start. It's a really long story, and I don't want to bore you because it's a really good story. I recently read the book by Eric Larson called Dead Wake. And it's a nonfiction retelling of the Lusitania story from a whole bunch of different perspectives, which is cool. He even kind of tells it from the German perspective of the U-boat captain who torpedoed the ship. So that was really good. I highly recommend
Spoiler.
It. Sorry.
Just saying.
I guess because it's a major part of world history and World War One, I thought most people knew that Lusitania was torpedoed by a German U-boat. But
well, if they didn't, they don't.
I promise there's more to the story. I haven't ruined it all.
You ready for the outro?
All right, I do think I'm going to need to start with talking about what was happening in the world just in general.
Okay.
And put it into context, I suppose. So this happened during World War One, but before America was in World War One. So World War One started officially in 1914. In July, that's when somewhere down in the Balkans, Archduke Ferdinand was shot in Sarajevo.
Right, right. And then the dominoes
that
fell.
Set off. Yeah, apparently. There were, like, all of these little countries were sort of, they had agreements with the larger countries in Europe, like France or Russia or Great Britain.
Mm-hmm.
They had, like, treaties.
Right.
You know, I'll back you up if someone attacks you. You're an ally. I'll help you. You help me, etc. And so that's why this little thing that happened, you know, way in the Balkans in the middle of nowhere. Sorry, Balkans. You're very lovely. That's why it is escalated, is because, you know, somebody had to back up Serbia and then somebody else had to back up Bosnia or whatever. And all these other countries in Europe that initially had nothing to do with it, they ended up getting involved because of these treaties that they had, these ally ships.
And you couldn't not follow through on your treaty because then you looked, you know,
well,
look bad, or no one believed you. And
it was probably maybe the last time we followed through on our treaties.
Ah, I see. turned out to be a bad idea, huh?
I don't know. I'm not saying we never follow through, but it's like the whole rules of warfare and kind of that gentlemanly, I don't know, clash of nations, rules of war, that kind of stuff we don't.
About the same time that duels went out of style, maybe, like that whole it was kind of a whole
and this was kind of the last time that armies sort of met on a battlefield and tried to kill each other face to face. It was really brutal, and they decided it wasn't a good idea to do that anymore.
But this was World War
that's
I.
not the topic.
Right.
Yeah.
And then we never did it again.
That was 1914.
We never had another World War.
Right. It was the war. the war to end all wars.
Okay, okay. Just making sure.
Yeah.
Also known as the Great War. So it was basically Britain, France, and Russia were kind of, they were the allied powers, and Germany and Italy and somewhere else was the central powers.
Mm-hmm.
And Germany was kicking butt, quite frankly. Them and their allies. They had just, they were very strategic in their warfare. They're very well placed in the middle of Europe there, kind of north middle. So the war was not going well for the Allied powers. America, they really wanted America to join the war, but we were like, we're not in Europe. This is like your thing. Like, we don't care about Sarajevo and some archduke. We just don't want to. Mm-hmm. Was our opinion at the time.
Yeah.
And so one of the significant things that gets mentioned when it comes to Lusitania often is that it was one of the things that got America to enter the war.
Mm-hmm.
But what surprised me, because I'd always known that, not always, not when I was born, but since I learned about World War One and Lusitania, I, like, I knew it was like, oh yeah, that made America mad and we got into the war. But it really wasn't like that. It wasn't like Pearl Harbor, where we're like, all right, we're mad.
Right.
President Grant sent a very strongly worded letter to Germany.
Ooh.
He said, please stop blowing up our things. And Germany was like, okay, I'm sorry. And so we held out for another 2 years before we finally joined the war.
Okay.
We were only, the war was a 4-year war. We were only in it for like the very end.
Mm.
We came in at the last minute and kicked butt. That's what we did.
Well, we were well rested.
Okay. We were well rested, yeah, and everyone else had been fighting for 3.5 years, and they were like, "Where the hell have you been?" we were dropping in I want to say something like 10,000 fresh soldiers a day for like 100 days in a row.
Jeez,
I mean, it wasn't, those numbers are a little inflated, but it was just like all the other soldiers were so tired, especially, you know, the German soldiers have been fighting so hard, and we just came in and we're just like, no, you're done. We shut it down. This is all true.
What we do.
Okay. So the Lusitania was a ship, a British ship, and it was of the Cunard line. So that's one of the primary ship lines of the time, the kind of luxury.
I think they're still in existence. I think they're still a thing.
Oh. They may be. So like the Titanic was White Star Line.
Mm-hmm.
White Star was another very big shipping line, primarily for doing a luxury passenger liner for crossing the Atlantic.
Okay.
It's mostly what they did. Zipped across, back and forth. Lusitania, prior to it sinking, it had made over 200 crossings.
You always hear about the luxury liners. Were there like non-luxury liners?
Oh yeah. Yeah. There were. And they were small and sad.
Mm-hmm.
And you probably don't hear about them for a good reason. They were not worth reporting on.
And no one cared if they got hit by a U-boat?
Well, maybe someone cared. Their mothers.
Okay. Just checking.
Yeah. Okay. So sometimes it's really hard to figure out what order to tell the story in. Okay, let's start.
So no, it had a regular line. I mean, it had a regular back and forth
route.
It did.
New York.
It did. And you can basically imagine the Titanic when you're thinking about the Lusitania.
Mm-hmm.
The Titanic was the fastest boat of its time. And
well, it didn't really make it to its destination.
I'm sorry.
Okay.
The Lusitania was the fastest boat of its time.
Okay.
Wrong boat. It could go 25 knots. And so that made it special. And it also, it was extra powerful because it had four boilers. So it had mm-hmm. four smokestacks. No other ships in the world that time had four.
Hmm. Ooh.
So that's important because she was recognizable. Like, you couldn't accidentally shoot her with something. She was the only ship that looked like that.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm.
And she was pretty fit. Like, everyone knew about her.
Because from the black and white photo here on, you know, Wikipedia, she looks like any other luxury liner, you know.
I wouldn't
have been able to tell the difference between this one and the Titanic of those others. But apparently, at World War II, they only had
three stacks, remember? Okay.
So, well, no. Yeah, I guess so, yeah.
It wasn't as powerful.
Okay. Now I know.
Now we're in the weeds. That's right. And I don't have very much else to say about the Lusitania. It was carrying a bunch of people. About 2,000 people.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be staff and, or crew, I should say, crew and passengers. And it had, there was first class, second class, and third class. And what was happening in the world was making ocean travel less enticing. First of all, who wants to go to Europe when it's
a
complete mess? So no, a lot of the other shipping companies had cut back or stopped entirely from going across. And the Lusitania was one where it was still making money because there were so few ships going, a lot mm-hmm. more people like had to go on the Lusitania because it was only one of the ones that was left. And they could afford, because it was so big and could carry so many people, they could afford to do a crossing. If they could fill it like half full, they could still make money on the crossing.
Mm-hmm.
So it was not the only ship that was still going across, but it was sort of a very prime one, and it was one of only a few that were still going back and forth regularly to Europe.
And was
its line went from New York to Liverpool.
Was it at capacity with the
no?
So it was still under it wasn't full.
It was not
the 2,000 was way.
They
less
had
than it could hold.
Yeah, I think it was probably a little over half full. They had sort of severely underbooked first class. I think there was only like a third of first class cabins were filled, and then their second class cabins were like massively overfilled. So a whole bunch of second class passengers got a little upgrade to first class. Oh. For free. So that was kind of like special. I mean, then they ended up drowning, so that wasn't good. But at least they got to be in first class for a while.
So this says, it says that it provided, this is when she was first completed, 552 saloon class. I don't know what that is. 460 cabin class. And 1,186 in third class. And then the crew was 69 on deck, 369 operating engines and boilers, and 389 to attend the passengers. That's a lot of people.
Yeah, right. That's the capacity, the full capacity.
It seems, yeah.
Third class was also not very full, maybe only a third full. So that was actually pretty cool for those passengers as well. Everyone was super comfortable. They could spread out. It should have been a very, very nice crossing.
It's like when you get on a long haul flight and no one's sitting next to you.
It's yep.
Like that. Yeah.
Exactly.
Oh, Love that. Yeah. It's exactly as luxurious as that to be on the Lusitania.
Yeah, I'm looking at this picture,
just like having
the lounge
one
and the,
extra
and the
airplane
music
seat.
Room. Yeah, that looks about as luxurious as a as a jumbo jet for sure.
I don't know what planes are flying.
It's an analogy.
Yeah. So all of the ships in Britain, they were pretty the there was some kind of war power that said that the Navy could, or they call it the Admiralty, could take it over and use it if there mm-hmm. was war. And initially they did take the Lusitania. They painted it all gray to make it look boring and to hide its to sort of hide its identity, make Operator Despot. But very quickly they realized it was fairly useless. It could go really fast, but it wasn't it couldn't maneuver very well, and it wasn't
it wasn't a warship. That's not for what the things they
that
needed.
Yes, for the things that the Admiralty needed to do on the ocean. I mean, other than troop transport, and they already had a bunch of other mm-hmm. ships doing that, so they didn't need any more. So the Lusitania was then kind of given back to the Cunard line, and they repainted it in its beautiful colors, and it resumed service. So I'm not sure how long it was sitting there gray, being used by the Navy, but anyway, that was happening, and everyone was aware at the time that that it was a little scary to cross. I mean, there had been some other boats that were sunk. I mean, the rule is if you're in a war with Great Britain, if you're Germany and you're in a war with Great Britain, and then, you know, some other ship comes along that's not from a country you're at war at, you should let it go. Or at the very least, let its people go and mm-hmm. steal its cargo. That was kind of the rule of the sea at the time, the gentlemanly rule of yeah. the sea. But now let me tell you, I'm going to switch gears for a little bit and tell you about submarines. So we'll get a little update on sort of what the German U-boat situation was at this time. Submarines, people started building submarines like really early, like the 1600s or something. But they weren't like for people at first, and they weren't successful at
first.
There was one that went underground, but it was paddled, and that was not successful. Paddling under the water.
I'm not sure
was
how
difficult.
That would work.
If they weren't for people, what were they for?
No, I mean, they were for people, but it was all kind of like prototype stuff, like as the science was getting was getting better. In the Civil War, we had submarines, both the North and the South, I think, had submarines. It was the first time that the submarines were used in warfare.
And we know that because we watched the movie Sahara.
That's right. And one of them took a whole bunch of Confederate gold across the ocean and landed
in a desert.
The Sahara.
The desert, somewhere in like Mali. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Totally happened.
It's all true. Yeah.
Definitely. This is all true. And it was the first successful like attack. It was February 17th, 1864. The Confederate submarine called H.L. Hunley shot a torpedo at the sloop USS Housatonic.
I hear a lot about sloops these days.
Just the sloop,
right,
John B.
I think that's the only one.
So that boat was sunk in Charleston Harbor, which is out North Carolina way. The force of the torpedo, like the reverberation or the, what's it called when you, like the blowback or the, anyway.
The shock
wave. Like the shock, that's it, the shock waves from having shot the torpedo and it hitting the boat. The sub just, it killed all the people inside and the sub sank in the hole. So it was successful. But only for a minute, because then the submarine itself.
Yeah, they hadn't done any scientific testing on that particular piece of it, on it actually shooting.
No. Well, the stories of people testing submarines are bleak.
Oh, I bet.
Like, there were not that many tests that actually had people in them because they were so dangerous you couldn't get people to do it. Because several of them, they just died. You take a crew of six or something down in your submarine and it wouldn't stand the pressure or something else would go wrong. There'd be a gas leak.
So many different.
There's a lot of ways to die in a submarine. Yeah. So we got better at it. We're a lot better at it now.
Well, that's good. I mean,
but it really wasn't. It was being perfected in World War One.
Mm-hmm.
As we were going into World War One, Germany had about 20 U-boats, and the U is for Unterseeboot. Unterseeboot. That means undersea boat in German. So they just called them U-boats, and they didn't name them, they just numbered them. So there's U1, U2, U3.
All of that is so original. I love
it. And yes.
Wait.
They're really creative.
That's not where the band U2 came from.
So they, at the very start of the war, they only had about 20. And the, I mean, they made
no,
more.
No, Caitlin, there's no connection. When,
I didn't think so. I just wanted to ask.
Just going to throw that in there.
Oh.
Go ahead.
Sorry, go ahead.
Continue.
I missed that question. Sorry. Whereas Britain had like over 100 submarines at the start of the war. However, the British submarine fleet didn't work and was fairly useless. And the German submarine fleet turned out to be really good. Like their submarines worked and didn't just kill their crew. So eventually the submarines, like they would run into each other a bunch. You couldn't navigate them, the British ones. Mm-hmm. They didn't end up using them all throughout the war. I think they used them a little bit and then were like, this isn't helping anything. Mm-hmm. We need to build better ones. Because Germany had somehow, you know, they had put their best minds to it or whatever and had built a really pretty good, for its time, ship design. It could go via diesel on the surface, or then it could go under and do a battery. The battery didn't last forever, so it couldn't stay underwater forever. It'd have to go up to recharge.
Could they get
the battery
that far away from the coastline? I mean, how long could they be out?
That was based on how much diesel fuel they had. I don't know the actual like total number of days. But they could get, I mean, this ship went from Germany all the way up around Ireland. So,
but it wasn't going all the way. It wasn't going across the Atlantic at this point. Okay.
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. Yeah. And in fact, it was more like they would, if you send a bunch of submarines out to kind of make a little like line, you can catch a bunch of ships close as they're coming close to shore, which is not close, but like within, you know, 30 miles or something. Anyway.
And so did they have the technology for like, I mean, for radar and to know where they were in the ocean?
No. Well, they could figure out where they were.
But they had a surface for that.
Some sort of mathematical way, I assume. But they really, they had to use ocean maps to navigate the seafloor. So
instead of sonar,
you couldn't.
Right. Stars.
Right. Like you couldn't get you couldn't sort of see under the water. They would be blind. So you'd look at your map and you'd hope that it was whoever mapped that part of the ocean floor was doing it.
Wow.
Because you could not see where you were going. And so when they needed to like sleep at night, they would take the ship down to like the middle of the ocean, like, you know, way far below the surface, but way above the ground as well. And that way they could keep like just going in the dark in a straight line all night long and then wake up in the morning and go up top and see where they were. So you had to surface to kind of look around and see anything.
So you couldn't, you'd have to be,
they couldn't have seen, they couldn't have seen that a boat was coming, like a blip. There was no blip on the radar screen or anything like that. You had to go up and actually physically see a boat through the
periscope. There's no pinging, is what you're saying.
In order to shoot something. No, there's no pinging. The one thing I think they could do is sounding, which I think is the right word for like doing like checking the depth. And I don't, but I think it wasn't like you get to see what everything around you is. It's just like specifically right now, how far are we from the bottom? Okay. And that wasn't like a constant stream of information coming in. Like if you wanted to know how deep you were, you had to do a task, you know, it was a task to do. So this is too boring and I apologize. That's submarine. Okay. The Germans were pretty good at it, is what I'm trying to say. The way that ships, not just these big cruisers, but any kind of ship that was in submarine infested waters was supposed to protect itself was to have lookouts to look for periscopes. Because whenever a periscope was up, even if it was kind of far away from you and you couldn't see the periscope itself, it left a wake, what's called a dead wake, which is why the book that I read was called Dead Wake. So it's like a telltale sign. And there's nothing you can do to stop that from happening. That's just the way the water works. So so they couldn't really, every time they came to the surface and put the periscope up, it was dangerous for the submarine too, because they could be spotted. And so you could zigzag your boat, because that made it hard for a submarine to line up a shot. And submarines couldn't go very fast. And so ideally you can go really fast and then just can't catch you. And the other tactic, let's see, zigzagging and going fast. That's all I can think of right now. Oh, and having people watch. Okay. All right. Let's talk about let's talk about Germany a little bit. Germany was fighting this war, and they wanted to step up their submarine game. And so they sort of had issued, the higher ups had issued an order to their sub captains that they could shoot anybody. Because initially they were just like everyone, they were trying to kind of follow the gentlemanly rules of battleship or whatever. and that required them not to shoot people that weren't involved in the war or that weren't a threat or weren't a military target. Now, America wasn't involved in the war, but the Lusitania, well, a lot of American ships, we weren't involved in the war, but we considered ourselves neutral, but we actually were supplying Britain with a ton of ammunition. And
well, we have to make money. I mean, whether we're going to be in the war or not, I mean, priorities.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, so we'd send over some ammunition. Sometimes we'd send over just the hard materials, and they would make it in their factories that they already had going over there. So, and we weren't doing the same for Germany. We weren't supplying both sides. We picked a side in the war, basically. Yeah,
so neutral, like you said.
We just weren't fighting it yet. So that is, you know, Germany's excuse for doing this. That's not their excuse. At the time, the captains had been told they could shoot down any boat, regardless. So even if there hadn't been ammunition on that boat, they still would have done it. But in retrospect, that's kind of it was, it was a warship kind of, because it had all this ammunition on it.
Okay.
But I think that's still complicated.
So there was enough room on this big ship. No. Well, I guess passenger was at half capacity. So I just, that seems.
Yeah. They just stored the ammunition in the open rooms, the open cabins.
Well, no, I would just.
No, when the boat was built. Mm-hmm. No, it's a, that's a, a good point. There probably wasn't as much luggage and whatever else if there's not that many people.
So,
but the boat, when the boat was built, the German government actually paid, no, the British government actually paid for it or subsidized a bunch of the costs in any case. And as like a, like in return, the Cunard Line had to promise that they would let the ship be used in wartime if needed. And B, they put a secret compartment in, they built in a secret compartment specifically for storing ammunition. Okay.
I just figured like goods would be transported, like wouldn't be on a, these kinds of things wouldn't be transported on a luxury liner. That would be more like, you know, some big, you know, shipping ship.
Yeah. But I think it did kind of double duty.
Well, and especially if you want
below
stuff
decks, they could do, and not just munitions, of course, you know, maybe it's a bunch of textiles or a bunch of whatever that we were. Beaver pelt. I mean, what were we selling?
This
at the
was
time?
Your,
I don't know.
Your 2-day delivery. Your Amazon. It's,
I think it was
so
mostly beaver
across
pelt.
The ocean. You get fast delivery.
Basically, this is Prime.
Amazon
this
Prime was the luxury
when you absolutely need it within 5 days.
So Germany did Germany know, or they just suspected or assumed? Well, of course, there's going to be, you know, war paraphernalia on this, on any.
They had no idea. It was for people. It was for people. And you know, so, well, okay. So here's another thing. Germany had, so at this point, everyone was doing everything in code.
Right.
As you can imagine, the communications and things. And there was this part of the Admiralty in England, and it was called Room 40 because it was in Room 40 in this particular building where that has the, like, house the Admiral offices or whatever. And this room was like the intelligence room. It was super, super secret. So they had actually gotten a hold of the code that Germany was using, so we could intercept. Like every time a submarine talked to land or to another subboat, we could hear it loud and clear. We knew exactly what they were saying. So we knew where they were. We knew what they were doing. And that sounds really fun, but because they really, really, really didn't want Germany to know that
they
we
had
knew,
to kind of play dumb sometimes.
So we couldn't, you couldn't act on everything. I mean, I would say, so they definitely knew that the Germans were talking about, in advance, the Germans were talking about possibly targeting the Lusitania, like specifically that boat. They were talking about where it would be and when it would be there. And otherwise they were, you know, they were talking about their own locations, and they were clearly going to be a several boats like in the path. But those notes never made it. I mean, it was so secretive that it was just like the top brass that knew about it. It, like, not even the greater intelligence community was given the information. It was just kept super secret, and it only came out late, you know, years later that we knew all along this was gonna happen. And there's, like, you know, people have conspiracy theories saying that maybe they wanted it to happen because it would get America into the war. I think that's hard to believe, because 120 some Americans died, but, you know, over 1,000 British people died, or almost 1,000. So I don't quite think those numbers add up. All right. So one important thing that happened, and this is another in the classic disaster sense of, in a big disaster, generally, it's not just the disaster, if there's like a whole bunch of other things that go wrong that kind of all happen at once. Yeah. At least two. So something that had happened just recently, before the sinking of the Lusitania, there in Britain, they had these old warships it's some kind of class. I don't know. It's a cruiser of some sort, and we wouldn't know what the name of the class of boat sure. was anyway. But they were really obsolete. They couldn't do very much, and so they were known kind of jokingly as the live bait squadron.
Oh, geez.
Because, like they couldn't hide. They couldn't maneuver. They were pretty useless. So there had been these three boats that were traveling in a squadron in, like, the southern North Sea in 1914. And they'd had some other boats with them, but they, for some reason, had to go. Like, they had some other, like, maybe more protective boats. So it wasn't, like, normally you wouldn't send these British cruisers by themselves. But they were going in a straight line, just as clear as could be. And a submarine was patrolling the area and saw them and was like, well, that's a sitting duck. I'm just going to go ahead and take that out. Because they were military targets, although they were just transport ships at the time. But not a significant naval target. But the U-9 was the U-boat that took them down. So it torpedoed the first boat, the Aboukir, and that took about 20 minutes to sink, and there was a loss of 527 men. And then the other two boats started approaching to assist, and so that one of the boats, the Hooge,
these are British boats.
They were already picking up survivors, pulling survivors up out of the water, and the U-boat hit two torpedoes at that one, and so it started to sink. And the third boat, which is called the Cressy, it had just come up upon this mess, and it came to a stop amid the survivors and was like about to start picking people up, and then they got fired on as well, two more torpedoes, and so they all sunk. And so in the aftermath of that event, the British implemented, there was a zigzag pattern, but also, you were never, if you were in a large ship, you were never supposed to approach a ship that was severely injured. You were supposed to steam away
and just let the people drown,
which is awful. So then the idea was then they would send out like some smaller ships that weren't
easy
so
to hit with a important. Or maybe easy to target with a from the submarine
to do the rescue. The problem is that smaller ships are almost always slower ships, and that ended up being a big problem with the Lusitania. So that was like a rule that was on the books. If you heard a distress signal and you knew that a big boat was sinking and you were nearby, but you were another target, you had to get out of the way. You couldn't go.
I know that this goes without saying, but war just really sucks.
So much.
You so can't much. Go help the, save the drowning people. You have to steam away and wait for a small, slow ship to maybe save some of them. It's just sad. Go ahead.
No worries. You are absolutely right. Okay. So the Lusitania takes off from New York. And another thing that goes wrong that is it more important than it sounds like is that as it's scheduled to leave maybe at like noon, 10, it doesn't matter what time, but at the last minute, there's another boat in New York Harbor, and that boat has just been requisitioned by, I think, the British Admiralty. And so they have to offload all the passengers from that small boat that was also just going to go across to Liverpool. So that's one of the like maybe cheaper, smaller crossings that would have been a lot slower. And they moved all those people onto the boat, onto the Lusitania, since they had the room, and it was basically these people would just get a much better ride for their money. And that delayed them for 2 hours. And so then they got out, and the truth is, timing wise, they never would have come across that
U-boat
submarine you know, like 4 or 5 days later or whatever, they never would have come up. They never would have met if they had gotten out of New York Harbor at the right
time. Interesting.
So it's also just like super by chance that these things,
even though the Germans were trying, I mean, they were talking about trying to target the ship and they knew it. I mean, presumably they knew its schedule.
They were talking in general. Yeah. It was Schweiger. He was the captain of U-20. He was not looking for the Lusitania. He was just going home to Germany. He'd been out and he'd sunk another boat and he was running low on fuel and he only had 3 torpedoes left. And so he was just on a run home. It was completely random.
So they weren't officially headed out directly to get this ship.
No.
They had talked about it, but weren't actively pursuing it, but it just, their paths crossed.
Yeah. And it, you know, it made multiple crossings. So it wasn't like, this is the, you know, let's get it today. I think it was kind of in the chatter that it might be right, a target kind of thing. If not this time, then maybe the next crossing, who knows?
So what month of the year are we in, Jill?
We're in May.
I just like thinking 7th. About the weather and the ocean temperature, things like that.
That part is interesting too. So throughout the trip across, the ship, first of all, in order to save a little bit of money, the Cunard Line had decided to only run 3 of the smokestacks were being used. And that meant they couldn't go their like top speed of 25. They could only go like 20 or 21. But
they had all these passengers who hadn't even paid the full price. So they didn't really care.
I mean, some people really like wanted to get, like they were on there because they knew it could get there in so few days. And it really wasn't going at the top speed, but even at like 20, it was still the fastest boat, faster than anything else that was going to come across. So that's how much faster it was than all the other boats. But actually, they ran into a ton of fog. So they're going across New York to Liverpool. They're in the North Atlantic, basically, not way up where there's icebergs, not at all.
They weren't in Titanic territory.
Sunk. No, and the Titanic had sunk in April, so this was a month later. Weather-wise, it would have been a little warmer. When it wasn't foggy, it was beautiful and sunny. So they had a nice trip over. It was kind of like, you know how sometimes in the morning it's foggy for like half the day and then the fog blows off? But the problem is fog was a major issue for boats at this time. Because again, there wasn't a good way to see if there were other things in your route, in your road. And it was really pretty common, especially when there were these sort of shipping lanes that were like commonly used by everybody. You think in the whole big ocean, how unlikely are you to like run into something, but it was very common for ships to run into each other in the fog. And that was another very common way boats would sink. So they had slowed way down in the fog, partly so that you could kind of see a little better. You'd have more time to maneuver if there was something up ahead. And they would use their foghorn to kind of announce that they were there.
That wasn't annoying at all for the passengers.
So that is, it really was. It really was annoying. So they used the foghorn, and the passengers knew about the danger of submarines. In fact, the German embassy in New York had put a notice in the paper. Like it ran in like 50 American newspapers, and it would often run like right alongside the ad for Lusitania tickets. The German embassy put a notice and said, just so you know, like Germany is taking this seriously. There are submarines out there. Your ship will be going through a war zone. Because all the water's like a certain way from Great Britain, a certain amount of miles or whatever, Germany had declared that wasn't like a militarized zone. So like that was, if you got too close to their enemy or whatever, they would maybe blow you up. So the passengers knew about this and they talked about it on the ship a lot. Like some of them were really worried, and the captain had kind of come to a couple of the big fancy dinners and like did a little speech kind of calming people down, saying, "Hey, we go really fast. We're, you know, I'm getting dispatches. So I know, you know, I'm getting safety updates all the time from the mainland and stuff like that." So he was calming the people down. And they also, there was some just kind of like gallows humor. Like a number of the survivors kind of told stories later about like jokes that they had made about, you know, well, it's our last night on Earth or whatever, or it's, you know, like how it's the last crossing, or just kind of even just like pretending to spot a U-boat, like how people who like, oh, I take a bomb to the airport. Like, why would you say that at the airport? But yeah, it was kind of like making a joke about like, oh, there's a torpedo.
Doing that on all of other crossings, you know, like.
Yes, maybe. Yeah, because it was dangerous for everybody, but it was in the notice that had been in the paper, it specifically mentioned the Lusitania.
Oh, okay.
Saying that. So it was kind of like the German embassy in New York was warning people not to get on it.
Spooky. Very spooky. Then it's just like, you know, are you bluffing? Are you just trying to, you know, make us cower? And
yeah,
so there's a lot of mind games going on.
I know. Trying to figure out their motive. Like, do they really want to save us? Why would they want to do that?
Or do they just want to interrupt? Britain was already getting those messages. So, you know, in getting their coded messages, and yet they were announcing it in America, that in the newspapers, that it could be a thing. So
yeah. a general announcement, a general murky kind of possible danger. Whereas at any given time, the people in room 40 knew exactly where the submarines were.
Okay.
Like, I mean, not like because they could trace them in the ocean, but because every time they radioed in, they would see they would get their coordinates and where they were going. So they could kind of predict where they'd be next. But they didn't share that information.
That's war.
All right. So fog, we had to slow down for fog. We were making funny jokes. It was a great trip across. There were some semi-famous people on board, none of which that I had heard of. Except I think there was not a Vanderbilt. It was.
The rich people of the day.
There were rich people, yeah. And some actresses and some famous composers and nobody that I'd heard of. But let's see. The morning of May 7th, the ship is in really, really, really dense fog, like as bad as it's been the whole trip. And now they're getting pretty close to the end of the trip. Like maybe it's the second to last day. As you come into Liverpool, as you get close to Liverpool, you have to deal with the tides. And if you have to hit the tides just right when you go through this, opening into the harbor. And if you don't hit them just right, then you have to sit and wait for the tide to change and get high enough for you to go in there safely. But then they're like a sitting duck just waiting for a submarine to come.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, if you're just sitting in the water, that's really, really dangerous. So as like knowing that the math wasn't adding up, the ship was going to get to that point and then have to sit and wait. And so the captain had kept the speed reduced even after the fog burned off, because he was thinking, if we, you know, I'd rather be moving a little slower and then get there at a time where we can just go right in safely. Totally makes sense to me. And he was going like 18 knots, which is still faster than any submarine could go. Like they can go like 9 or something at the time. And so the captain of the U-boat, his name is Schweiger, he came up to the surface on this day, and he saw way on the horizon, he saw a bunch of, he could see some smokestacks, and so he's like, oh, there's a bunch of boats over there. He really thought it was multiple
after
boats.
The smoke burned off.
So they kind of got
the fog.
Sorry,
after the fog,
right? Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, yeah. Well, in fact, fog is super dangerous for submarines too, because their preferred method of travel is to travel on the top, because then they can use their diesel engines and have it exhaust coming out, and it charges their batteries when they're using their diesel engine. So they can be down below more, and. So if they're traveling on top, A, they can be seen. Obviously, they're not going to be seen that much in the fog, but one of the best ways to sink a U-boat, and we've sunk several of them this way in wartime, is to just ram a ship right into them. Like, the submarine, at least at this point, could not withstand that. So, in fact, that was the actual, if you do come across a submarine and you can manage it, ram it, and it'll go right down. So he didn't want to get rammed by anything. So they stayed during the fog. They had to stay down, and they went specifically they knew the depth of the deepest, the boats with the deepest keel.
Oh, right.
And they had to stay below that, so that no matter what, a boat could go right over top of them, and they would still be safe down there. So he'd gone up to see if the fog had burned off, and it was burning off, and he could see these smokestacks in the distance. Went up to look a little bit later, and this time he could see that it was just one boat, and it was
it had all four smokestacks.
It was the only one, and so he's like, oh my god, this is amazing, I've got to get this one. And he initially is sort of following the boat, and then the captain of the Lusitania, I haven't even talked about him, his name is William Turner. And he turned the boat, he did a zag. And he started going away from the U-boat. And so
he saw the U-boat.
Captain. No.
Oh, he was just zigzag.
No. The turn had nothing to do.
He was just doing.
You were just supposed to zigzag?
Just a regular routine maneuver. And, okay.
Yeah. Also, he was receiving notifications throughout the day from the coast what am I trying to say,
the Coast Guard, whatever, the
the intelligence office on the shore, because they were giving him dispatches about what they were, where, you know, just very general ones, but about where they thought the how to evade the submarines, and where they had heard they last were. Again, this isn't coming from room 40, who had the exact coordinates. This is the general intelligence, which they only knew where a submarine was if it was spotted by another boat. And so there had been, another boat had spotted a submarine. That actually turned out to be completely false. But so he was zigging, specifically zigging away, because they'd been told that there was going to be a submarine. And so which is why he was zigzagging. Anyway, he zags back, and that's when the captain of the U-boat is like, he is exactly lined up for the shot. He kind of lined himself up for the shot. The U-boat didn't even have to do anything hardly to get in line. And so he ordered that they load a torpedo, a gyroscopic torpedo, which you must know. And it was at a running depth of 2 meters. So it was under the ocean that far. And so it would hit
below the water, I guess. Line.
Yeah. The folks on board, the watchmen who were looking for torpedoes, they saw the torpedo, and they did do hey, there's a torpedo! But it was just so fast, there was nothing anyone could do except hold on to something. And also, so remember, as you're imagining this, remember that the fog has burned off. It's the middle of the day. And it's gorgeous, sunny weather.
So everybody's outside.
So it's also
working
just
on their tan.
Yeah. I mean, I have a hard time imagining it that way. I have to keep going back and be like, no, this is not in the middle of the night like the Titanic. This right. is, we got to picture this in the daylight. So the torpedo hits. It's a very big, they hit the starboard side. There's a very large explosion, like way larger than a torpedo would usually make. And so it's not known exactly why that was. It could have hit something.
That secret compartment with all of the bombs.
Coal
that
or coal dust or something. Yeah, maybe. I don't know. The ammunition, it was small arms right. and it wasn't. I don't think it could have been that unless there was something on the ship that we right. really don't know about, which is possible. Because what we know was on there, it was like small arms and there were like shrapnel casings, which I don't know what a shrapnel casing is, but my assumption is it's something you put shrapnel in.
Yeah.
yeah. And, but it sounds like it's like an unfinished part.
Okay.
Like it doesn't have, like it's not, I don't know that it was ready. And plus with all those passengers on there, I don't think that they often carried
something so dangerous.
The kind yeah. of, yeah. I mean, they could carry a lot of war related material that weren't the blow up-y kind. Anyway, so what most people suspect is that what happened is that one of the boilers was damaged in the explosion and it immediately right. exploded as it came in contact with water and air and everything. And then there was sort of a secondary explosion, which has caused some people to claim there was a second torpedo, but there wasn't a second torpedo. The German, we have like the original log books from Germany now. The war's over. And they clearly just fired one. And so the second explosion was probably yet another boiler going. So here's another thing that went wrong that was unfortunate. That morning, because they're getting close to their embarkation, disembark.
Right. Destination?
Disembarkment?
Yes, thank you.
Their disembarkment at the destination.
The crew is doing an exercise. They're like, not the whole crew, of course. Someone has to drive the boat and serve the food, but like half the crew was down in the like storage area and they were doing a drill to kind of practice like quickly, like how to, like where everything is stored, how to quickly move off the boat, etc. And they were, that part of the boat was, they were probably all killed in the first blast, like immediately.
But if they hadn't,
and the significance of
if
that
they hadn't,
is that they,
if they hadn't been doing the training, like this once per crossing training, they a lot of the crew would have survived.
Yeah, and not just that, but the crew, they also had there was a set of crew members assigned to each lifeboat.
Mm-hmm. Oh, so they weren't spread out where they were.
It's really hard to, like, you kind of have to be trained in how to get those lifeboats unhooked and how to carefully lower them down, etc. And so there were just way fewer folks, especially experienced folks who really knew what they were doing as they were lowering the lifeboats. The boat immediately is listing really hard to starboard. So that's it's lifting towards the part that was
damaged.
Obviously the part that was shot, water's coming in and it's really tilting fast. Here's another problem with lifeboats just in general. I will say, first of all, they totally had enough lifeboats for everyone on board. So there's not that problem.
That's smart.
It is pretty clever. Yeah. In fact, they even had extra.
Well, of course, because they were only at capacity.
Like enough,
so everyone could have their own lifeboat.
Pretty much, yeah. They had like those classic wooden ones that we are still using today for some stupid reason. And then they also had some like some kind of canvassy ones that could be like unfolded mm-hmm. into a boat, like into like a rafty boat.
If you have some time to unfold something.
None of those were successfully launched, but they did get washed overboard and a lot of people were able to like lay on them. Like right. Rose's door. So the boat is tipping and it's also the captain tries to do two things right away. He first tries to go very sharply towards land. So tries to make a big turn. And the ship doesn't respond. Like the engine room is not, it must be, we don't know specifically what happened, but the engine room must be damaged beyond the point that it can respond. And so then he tries to put the boat into reverse. And that also is a no-go. Putting it into reverse was to stop it, you know, to slow it to a stop, which is how you stop these big things. So he couldn't stop it and he couldn't turn it. So one of the significance of not being able to stop the boat, and I hadn't really thought of this before, but you cannot launch a lifeboat unless the boat is standing still.
Oh, yeah. So does a question.
You hit the water and it'll... You know, if the boat is going 18 knots and your lifeboat hits the water, you're going to be ripped off. Or dragged along, or, you know, there's no way that's going to work. So it took about 10 minutes from the time that the torpedo hit for the boat to slow down enough on its own.
Okay, that was going to be my question.
That they could start putting lifeboats in the water. And again, so also another problem with lifeboats, then this is another universal boating issue, is if the boat's tipping, lifeboats are not very easy to use. So on the starboard side, once you got the boats like unhooked from the deck, then they were hanging out.
Too far over, right?
Too far.
Right. And then on the other side, then they can't.
On the other side,
out over the
you edge. Can still lower them, but they scrape badly against the side of the boat, and none of the boats on the port side were successfully launched.
Oh, that sucks.
One of them was launched, but it was damaged so bad in like the going down in like the running over the side of the boat that it got holes in it and it sank immediately. Like as soon as it got to the water, it just filled with water. Those people didn't necessarily die. They got out of the boat and hopefully swam to some debris or something. But they had very good. Oh, so yeah, the lifeboats on the starboard side were hard to use because they were dangling far from the ship. But they were able to lower a few of them. Either before it tipped too far or maybe they were just lucky. You know, one guy told a story about how people had to jump 5 feet from the deck to the boat. And that's a really long way to jump. I mean, possible, but hard. Like they were throwing children across.
Yeah.
And he said, he said they didn't lose a single person. They filled up the boat and even like elderly people managed to make the jump. And he was saying like, I guess if your option is like die or make this jump work, you could do it. Mm-hmm. So that was one boat. But in the end, of the total of 48 lifeboats that were on board, only 6 were successfully lowered and launched. A whole bunch of others were attempted to be launched, but they just a whole bunch of things went wrong. Like if you let go of the rope, then one side would fall and everyone would be tipped out. If the boat made a big sway or something, there could be a tip. If people tried to jump in, like if too many people were trying to jump in on one side while you were lowering the boat down, that could tip the boat and everyone would fall out. There were some stories of boats being lowered in such a way that like crashed into people and actually smashed the people below. I don't quite understand how that happened, but anyway. The other thing is that in the end, the boat was sunk completely in 18 minutes.
Wow.
Such a...
They couldn't even lower the boat successfully until 10 minutes had passed, and then we're talking about 8 minutes of chaos.
Yeah, that makes way more sense.
Lowering boats. And then there's 18 minutes is also not a lot of time to grab your life jacket. At this time, the life jackets were in everyone's stateroom. Like you'd have, you know, your two would be stored in some closet in your stateroom, which I don't think they do anymore. Because really, you're going to need them when you get out onto the deck, and you're not going to want to go back to your stateroom. Right. The electricity was totally out. Like, that's another thing. Once the engine wasn't working and the boilers had exploded, there was no electricity. So it was completely dark on the interior of the boat. So it's sinking very fast. People are in the water. And again, beautiful sunny day, crystal clear, smooth water. And this massive disaster happening. Just hard to imagine. Some of the boats that did get away, like of the six boats, there were a couple that only had like eight people or five people in them. And those people pulled a bunch of other people into the boats. Like this, so they were able to get some survivors into the boat. There was one boat, one of the life rafts, and I don't remember exactly the total number that they're supposed to hold, but I think it can't be more than like 40. This boat had like 150 people.
That's crazy.
One of the lifeboats by the time that the rescuers got there. And then, you know, other people were in the water. Oh, we got life vest. So a lot of people just didn't have them on. They were also this new style of life jacket. Apparently there was an older version of life jacket that just because of the way the buoyancy, like where the buoyancy was placed in the life jacket, if you were unconscious, it would tip your face forward into the water.
Yeah.
And then you would die. So this one, if you were unconscious, it would tip you back so you could still breathe. Mm-hmm. Really good idea. But a lot of people didn't know how to put them on. There was a report that like it was confusing design and the straps were everywhere and some people had their arms through the wrong spot. And so that didn't end up being as helpful. Okay, so Captain Turner, again, on Lusitania, he's at the bridge, of course. And there are multiple people who can confirm this. They saw it. So, I mean, that's important only because he survives and they maintain that he did stay with the bridge until the boat sunk in general. But he wasn't in the bridge room. He was standing on the deck right outside. The wave kind of swallowed him up, but he came up alive and he found a chair to float on. And he was unconscious when they picked him up.
But, he was blown off off the ship?
Yeah.
So by a wave.
Like as the water was doing its choppy swallowing the last of the boat kind of thing.
Wow.
He was like washed away in a wave and somehow resurfaced still alive.
On a chair?
Awakened. No. He wasn't unconscious. He was able to get to a chair,
which
he hung on to. But then he went unconscious. He wasn't conscious when the rescue boats got there.
I see. Okay.
Which could have been some kind of trauma, or it could be because of the weather. I mean, not the weather, the temperature of the ocean.
When you say the rescue boats, do you mean the other lifeboats, or are there now? I mean, the other ships, if there were any other ships in the area, they were supposed to go away from this, right?
Correct. So. Let me get into that. I will. Because that's a story too. But just one last thing about the captain. He grabbed all the logbooks and the charts when he had them like attached to his body or somehow. So they were saved. So just useful like in figuring out what happened. He had like all of the individual like notations of exactly where he was and what was going on. which helped them find at the end, they didn't go looking for it until the end of the war, but it helped them find the wreckage of the Lusitania super easily once the war was over. All right, so they were able to send out an SOS message
in those 18
and it was
minutes.
Acknowledged within probably within the first couple of minutes.
Yeah.
And it was acknowledged by a coastal radio station, a coastal station.
Mm-hmm.
There were boats nearby, but again, any of them that would have been close enough to rescue would have been moving away at that point per the recommendation. There wasn't like there was a boat in sight that they could like they saw going away.
The further they get away, I mean, it's just going to take them that much longer to eventually get there to rescue anybody. But and the U-boat, I mean, they would have known this, but the U-boat still has two torpedoes. So
it does. And according to witnesses and the captain's log on the U-boat, he watched for a little bit after he watched at least long enough to see that the explosion was much bigger and that the boat was definitely going to go down. It was listing so far to starboard that he's like, there's no way.
Yeah.
You know, he didn't need to shoot them again, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Even at a time of war, it's uncomfortable to watch a whole bunch of people die that you just shot. So they went away real fast after that. Like, they kind of fled the scene. And they went home and they received like the highest. They were national heroes.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause Germany was a little rough sometimes.
Yeah.
So the rescue boats came from the coast. They came from the boat sunk about 11 miles off the coast of Ireland, and there was a medium-sized fishing village there with a port, and they got the news, and a whole bunch of people who had boats went out there. They did have one boat that was especially large and, like, I'm not sure what kind of boat it was or who owned it or why it was at this fishing village, but it was large and fast. Like, it could have gotten those 11 miles, it could have gotten there in within an hour.
Mm-hmm.
And it actually did start going out. And then some higher up person called to say, hey, no, go back to port. You're too important. We can't, we can't send you. So it was only these little fishing boats. I mean, not dinghies. But it was just a little, like, the local people who went out and rescued.
There wasn't any other military or...
No. Yeah, no.
Huh.
We're practically angry about it. So there, it took about 3 hours to get there. And the real problem with that is that for some of the people who didn't get in a lifeboat but did survive and they were floating on something or just floating with their life jacket, the water was 52 degrees. Not immediately going to kill you, but after 3 hours, it's getting pretty bad. So some of the people had already kind of succumbed to the cold, especially if they were sort of fragile or had an injury or something.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So some people died in those 3 hours for sure. But then they collected the survivors and that was great. Then the British government actually, put up a reward to the fishermen in that area for every dead body that they could collect over the following like several weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And so they would, I mean, you would see them floating or they would wash up on shore. But that way they could get them back to their families or whatever. Well, actually almost all of them were buried right there on the coast of Ireland, but at least they could have a headstone with a name, etc.
Mm-hmm.
There were total of 761 survivors, 1,198 died. And of those that died, 885 bodies were never recovered.
So
even with that, so many of them must have been trapped inside the ship. I mean, it was dark in there and it went down so fast, and
a lot of panic.
It went down. I also will say, like, the Titanic broke. This one didn't break. You know, it was going nose down. It did go nose down. It got high enough in the air that the propeller could be seen. Because people in the water mentioned that they did get to see the propeller at some point before it very, very quickly under the water. That's the story, you guys. Well, no, let me give you a little bit of the afterword. The Captain Turner, and of course, initially people tried to blame it on him. The Admiralty tried to blame it on him. The shipping company tried to blame it on him. And there was kind of this big trial. It wasn't a trial. It was an inquest. That's what they called them, I think. And so they were
know that it was hit by a U-boat?
Oh, yeah, they did. But they were looking for some kind of mistake that Turner had made that like put him in the line of the U-boat.
Just blame it on the U-boat. Like, why do we have to find another source?
It was the pettiest thing in the world to try and blame someone who was torpedoed for sinking a boat. No, he was completely exonerated. And it was like, no, in the end, they decided that the real culprit was Germany, who was killing people indiscriminately.
Shock.
And then, as I mentioned, we didn't get into the war, but it did make America really angry. So it helped kind of turn public opinion, because we really, really didn't want to get involved. Like, not just we, meaning President Grant, but just like the people.
It wasn't popular.
That excited about it. And then this kind of started to make us feel like we needed to get involved. And as I said, President Grant sent a sternly warning.
Would this have been the kind of the first non-military target that had kind of purposely?
It was the first
time
Americans had died in the war.
But had other non-military targets been hit, or
possibly? But they were at least still from countries that
we didn't care about
involved.
At the time.
They were like rather European countries that were all involved in.
I see.
So this, the 128 Americans that were killed, that was the reason that we were started to think about getting involved. But it took another couple of years. And one of the reasons is Grant had sent these letters to Kaiser Wilhelm, which, I mean, it's just so not a proportional response to send an angry letter.
Right, no, but, not at all.
Right, but that's what they did. And he said, you have to stop shooting indiscriminately. Like, you have to have your subs follow like the rules of law, etc. And that kept Germany agreed, so they changed their policy and made it again so that they had to give grant safe passage to luxury liners or whatever who was not military or anyone who was neutral party.
So
that lasted.
I'm surprised that worked.
I mean, Germany must have been at least a little worried about the U.S. getting involved then.
You know, I think so, but it is, they do something that does, so 2 years pass, and they do two things. First, they go ahead and change, like, at this point, the war has been dragging on for 3 years, and they're like, we're tired of this now, we want to just really hit it hard. So they change their policy back. We're just going to kill every boat that we find. Scorched earth policy. And then, which made us pretty angry, like, because we knew the policy had changed. I don't know that there was another big sinking of an American ship or anything. It was just the policy clearly changed. And then Germany, for reasons I don't understand at all, was trying to work with Mexico to partner with Mexico to start attacking America from the south. Huh. Germany had promised Mexico in return, once they had taken us over or whatever they were going to do, they would give Mexico back those southern lands that they had had, the, you know, Arizona, New Mexico, Southern California. So they were like working on that kind of a treaty for or something. We, our intelligence people, found out about that, and that was like the... So that's why I'm not sure. I don't know why Germany would have wanted us, unless they were just getting... They were winning the war in Europe, and if they were just getting really cocky, and like, why don't we take over America while we're at it? And they... I also... It sounds like they didn't think that if America joined the war that we would mobilize very quickly, because we weren't... We hadn't been preparing for war. And to a certain extent, that was right. We, Congress declared war in, what was it, 2016? Where's that date?
2016.
thereabouts.
Yeah.
Close to.
Keep up, Caitlin. It was a long war. In, I think it was 1917. I'm so sorry. July of 1917, Congress declared war, and we started to mobilize, but it did take us a while, and it wasn't until like early to mid 1918 that we started putting troops on the ground in Europe. And when we, but when we did, it was like an instant turn of the tide, because it was like all like hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of fresh troops, and almost an endless supply. We're a big country. We had lots of young men who wanted to come do this. And so it was a quick, they had to surrender within only a few months of us joining the war. No, I'm sorry. It was, we'd been in, technically been in the war for a year and a half, but we'd only had people on the ground for a few months.
I see.
And then the war was over. And then nothing ever happened bad again.
And we learned our lesson about world wars.
And all the countries were divided up fairly, and there were no conflicts.
The end.
And no more I ships told you it had ever happened. Sank.
Well, sometimes they did, but they were, they would come to the surface again.
That's right. That's right. As we learned last time. Oh, wow.
The Lusitania, by the way, we do know where it is, and like, a few things have been brought up, like the anchor, I think. But because, I mean, for some reason, the government of Britain says that it's too dangerous because of the munitions that were on there. So there's no, like, you're not allowed to, like, dive down there. It's not safe.
So
yeah, very few people have actually seen it. But there you go.
I see. Yeah.
I think that it's kind of interesting from like it is a piece of history, but I'm not one of those people that thinks that every single shipwreck needs to be brought up in its entirety to the surface. I don't know. I feel like it you know, bring up a couple of doodads, that's okay, but we don't have to have everything up. Brought up, let it lie.
We can leave it there. Okay,
just the doodads. I don't know what part of a ship is the doodads. We'll bring up the doodads. Yeah, just a little something for a museum, and then so there is a museum right there off the coast of Ireland, and probably another naval museum somewhere in Greater Britain that has some of the little. Some of the pieces, doodads, but the ship is, in general is down there.
Well, I'm going to have to add that to my Ireland trip then. I didn't realize that.
Yeah, swing by there. Take a tour.
You know, when people can travel again.
It's at the very southern tip of Ireland.
Huh. Well, I missed it the first time. I was thinking, well, maybe it's Northern Ireland. Maybe that's why I missed it. But no, I did the southern tip, and I just apparently didn't care about my history when I went.
Now you know.
Well, thanks, Jill. Good story. Wow.
Yeah. I
sure,
appreciate
we'll
that.
Try to make the next one not about a boat sinking, but I'm not really sure. I'm currently reading a plane crash book, so we'll see how that story works out.
Okay.
Does it maybe crash into the ocean? We could have a theme. Only ocean crash.
It doesn't. No. Papua New Guinea.
Oh, okay.
In the jungle.
Okay. That but, that actually sounds really interesting. Hmm. So Jillian, you did mention the resource, a book that you read just for our listeners. Can you repeat that name and the author maybe?
Dead Wake by Eric Larson. And okay. I got almost all the info from there, but then also did a read through of Wikipedia, a couple different pages, you know, the one on Lusitania. I read the World War I one.
Mm-hmm.
And I read the about submarines and about U-boats and I clicked on all the links to all the appropriate Wikipedia articles. So.
Deep dive.
And Jema,
there are a couple apparently good movies and documentaries, but I didn't know that until today. I didn't have time to watch them.
Add that to the to-do list. Jema, for the people who might want to see visuals, would we recommend the Wikipedia page? I know that you said that there were some pictures of the four stacks, but there's probably no pictures of the sinking. Yeah.
There's no pictures of the sinking.
But you get some nice,
but there are a lot of very shots,
very fancy,
very boat. Well, there are some very well done drawings of the event.
Okay.
I don't see those on the Wikipedia page though. Maybe if you just Google it.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah. No, I just wanted to ask if there was any anything we could direct our listeners to. But no, that sounds awesome. Yeah. I'm glad you enjoyed the book so much.
Yes, me too. Eric Larson is a great writer. All right, folks. Thank you for tuning in.
Yeah, thank you, Jill, for sharing the story with us. And to all our listeners, we hope you have a great week and we'll catch you next time.
We hope you enjoyed the episode. Before we go, we want to leave you with a few ways to keep in touch.
First of all, we hope you'll subscribe to our podcast and rate it and tell your friends so that other people can discover our content.
But if you want to give more feedback or send us topics, suggestions, here's how you can keep in touch.
You can find us on Facebook and Twitter.
You can email us at calamitypodcast@yahoo.com.
You can visit our website at calamitypodcast.com.
And you can support this awesome project on Patreon.
We hope to hear from you soon.